Frisbee, former director of admissions, January 13th, 1989. We'll start at the top of the checklist. All right.
Okay.
So, and then you can free float after. We get farther down here. You're not confined to it by any means. Name, department, rank, and position.
Well, that's at the present time. Or at the time when.
At the time that we're
talking about.
We're talking about. I'd like to know what you're doing now, but I also want to know what you were doing when you were director of admissions.
Okay. Well, I'm Dan Frisbee, and I joined the undergraduate admissions office on August 1st, 1965 as an admissions counselor working for the then director, Ed Malloy. A fellow by the name Bob Haberman was assistant director of admissions, and Margaret Sullivan, who is now assistant to the chair in the physics department, was also a counselor there. And Wayne Carhart, there were four of them, and I became the fifth. And, two more were added that year because Dr. Toll was to join the campus the same summer in 1965. And I think I've mentioned this to you before, that I was the last person in the admissions office interviewed by you, and you were in effect the acting president at that time. I think your title was chief administrative officer.
Right.
In the catalogs they listed it that way, but I recall that very vividly. Ed had taken me up to meet you. I think Sheldon Ackley was outside, and I remember Sheldon seemed a little upset at that time because he didn't know that interview was going to take place, and he was questioning Ed a good deal about how did this happen to be. But anyway, Ed took me in and introduced me to you, and we chatted for about 15 or 20 minutes. I remember that you asked me a rather difficult question, perfectly natural from your point of view, and you asked me, now how would I go about getting a freshman class into Stony Brook? And I had not actually had direct admissions experience. I'd done alumni interviewing for my alma mater, Union College in Schenectady, and I had taught for 14 years in secondary schools at that time, so it wasn't as difficult a question, really, in a sense, and I remember saying we would have to contact the guidance departments and schools in the area and convey to them the kinds of students we were seeking and elicit their assistance in doing that and so on. But your field was history, and I had taught history in secondary school, so I think we sort of hit it off at that time, and that turned out favorable, and I began employment on August 1st. I was informed about the position opening in admissions by a friend at the College of Geneseo, who was then an assistant director of admissions. His name was Bob Riedel. He later became director of athletics there, just retired last year. Outstanding athlete. All high school in Buffalo, for the whole city of Buffalo. Played professionally for a while. Unfortunately, he wasn't that good a hitter. And he was in the Pirates chain, and he went down to the Big Texas League in 1954, but manager told him if he could hit 250, they'd have sent him to the Pirates immediately because they needed catchers. I never honestly saw a catcher that I thought in the major leagues did the job better than this fellow did. The strongest arm I ever saw I used to play center field because I was fast, and I used to kid him, but if any runners ever tried to steal center field, he could throw them out. Or sometimes he threw so hard it sailed right over the second baseman's head, but marvelous player. Well, anyway, he told me there was a position open, and that Ed Malloy was a nice man, and I should contact him, and I did. He was right. I thought the world of Ed.
Ed's a fine person.
Great gentleman.
I've lost touch with him, really.
Well,
is he still at Sealand's Grove?
No, he retired. He's living there, yes. He's still living there, and Ann has also retired. But I think Ed's been retired now about 5-6 years or so. Things kind of went a little downhill for Ed after he left here. It wasn't a good experience at Union where he'd gone to be dean of students. But it was just a terrible time to be a dean of students anywhere, 1968 to 73.
Right.
It was the activist period. Nobody was really prepared to cope with that kind of activity and that kind of action from students. I don't think anybody knew how to handle them. Ed was just exhausted. He was living on campus. He was on call all night. He left there, went to Sealings Grove as vice president for student affairs. I don't think the experience there was all that successful either, and I felt very badly about that because he deserved better. He was a fine man. He is a fine man.
Yeah.
He's had a bypass operation. He did not have a heart attack, but he did have to have, I think, 2 bypass operations, and then he had a little cancer in the back of his back, and last I knew, that's under control. So he's doing okay, and they took a trip to England. Anne wrote on Christmas card this year. But I felt very badly when he left here. I just couldn't imagine the admissions office without Ed Dean there. And then Dave Tilley was moved over to admissions. Of course, you remember that experience in January 1968. I remember coming to work that January day and seeing police cars all up and down Nichols Road with buses coming onto the campus and seeing news people from CBS, NBC, ABC, Reuters.
They had been carefully notified.
You bet they had.
Did you ever see the manual that was gotten out?
I only saw a picture of it.
The night in the harbor.
They said it was nearly an inch thick.
Yes, that's right.
They had the floor plans of all the dorms. They had pass keys to it. There had been undercover agents apparently on the campus. It was
a production.
Terrible. I always felt badly that Rockefeller let it go forward, but I guess in his position, maybe if he had blocked it, it would have looked as if maybe he was trying to cover up something. But there really wasn't all that much here anyway, because none of those kids was ever indicted, or convicted, I believe. My recollection, the 25 or so that were arrested and taken off with small amounts of marijuana, they never really found anything that was all that bad. I remember Bob Haverman's marvelous comment. He said, look, he said, our kids are adventuresome. They're not stupid. They don't get into heroin. And I think that was true. When we visited high schools that fall, in the fall of 68, I used to have counselors sort of ask me in a confidential way, how bad is the drug problem on your campus, you know, looking left and right. And Haverman developed this marvelous method of warding that off. And he'd sort of look around and lean forward to the counselor and say, how is it in your school? And he said, in every case, the counselor would say, you know, we wouldn't believe it. We got a few kids in this school that are in trust. And Bob would say, where do you think we got it from? Came from the secondary school. We didn't invent drugs on this campus. It happened to erupt here, and we had an ambitious commissioner of police
They had, the Republicans at that time had a problem with, I think it was the sewer district.
Oh, terrible, yeah, that southeast.
Southeast sewer district. And I wanted to get attention away from that.
Yes, and that was it. I also heard that he was seeking re-election, John Barry, I believe, was the man's name.
Yeah.
But I thought he did this university, the SUNY system, and the people of Long Island a terrible disfavor by carrying that out. But to get back to my story, you know, I think Dave Tilley was given, perhaps unfair in some ways, responsibility for not properly alerting the administration that there was some drug use on the campus. And
wasn't he still dean of students?
Yes, he was.
Yes.
Yeah, he was dean at that time. And I can still remember watching the news that night on television with Alec Pond sitting there with Dave Tilley, and the two of them looked like they'd just both been sentenced to 20 years in Siberia. They were as grim as anyone could look, and understandably, because so much attention had been given to this raid. As you point out, it was well planned, well publicized. All the media were notified and were carrying it. I understand even, we heard that even Pravda had written an article about it.
Is that right?
Yes. And I heard from others that some of the German newspapers, the French newspapers, English newspapers, it was picked up on news services, Kerry.
Well, Stony Brook had quite a lot of publicity since Johnny came, and particularly Frank Yang and Bentley Glass, kind of quality appointments that he'd made, and stories around that, stories around the development of Stony Brook. And then suddenly this.
Yes.
But Berkeley was also
yes.
In the picture.
Yes, yes, it was. It sort of took the bloom a little off Stony Brook for a while. Not sure it ever really recovered. And I think it also was the beginning of a shift in the mix of students on this campus. We weren't immediately aware of it, but by sometime in the mid-70s, it was clear that where we had a large representation of students of the Jewish faith, a small representation of Catholic students, and a fairly steady percentage, which still persists today, I believe, at the Protestant level, the Jewish and Catholic percentages just shifted. Yes, yes. The number of Jewish students began a steady decline, and the number of Catholic students showed a proportionate increase.
Why did you come to Stony Brook? What factors were important in your decision?
Probably was, to a large extent, some dissatisfaction with the way secondary school teaching was practiced on Long Island, and in particular the school that I was working in. I had only been down here 2 years at the Commack School District, which was then listed as the fastest growing school district in the United States, and it really was astounding. It eventually reached some 17 schools, several thousand students that were in that school district. It's all shrunk now, going back. But I had a marvelous system in western New York. I taught in, lived in East Aurora, New York, just south of Buffalo, and taught in a small central school district in Elma, New York, called Iroquois Central, and so many schools up there have Indian names, as you know, in New York State. And I worked for a marvelous principal up there, and I was chairman of my department, social studies department. Came down here, and there were some nice people, and kids are pretty much the same, I found, most everywhere. But the administration here wanted people to all be teaching the same thing on the same day. We had to be in lockstep. And it seemed to me it destroyed something very valuable, that each person brings certain personality traits and a certain style of teaching to the task. And what works well for you is the way you should approach your subject matter and how you teach it. And I felt that that was not being permitted here. And I remember
here in Commack.
Yes. I can't generalize and say that's true in all schools because I only worked in the one. But I remember having a discussion with the principal over there. He'd come over to observe me. And when we talked about it afterwards, he said, you know, you're the kind of teacher, he said, we could make a television segment out of. He said, if you, you know, would just make a couple of changes in this or that or the other thing. And and I said, well, but if I make those changes, then it's not me. It's not my approach. And I remember using an analogy with him. I said, you know, if a coach had told Stan Musial that he could improve his batting average 10 points by widening his stance instead of using that closing stance, would that be smart to do and risk the fact that he might drop down to a 250 hitter because that happens to work well for him? Well, that seemed to upset the principal a lot. But it didn't change. I could just see more and more of it. The chair of the department wanted everybody doing the same thing. And I talked to my friend Bob Riedel about it. And he told me. He said, you know, there's an opening in admissions. He said, you might enjoy that. I'll try it. So I wrote to Ed in January. I didn't hear from him until March. Not until after I got in the office. Ed's desk used to be piled a foot high with documents and things. But I came in for an interview, and he introduced me to people. And then I didn't hear from him again until the end of the school year. My wife had just gone in for a D&C, and 4 o'clock one afternoon, I was home having a glass of beer, but feeling sorry for myself. And the phone rang, and it was Bob Haberman. He said, you still want a work job over here? I said, is it too late to start this afternoon? And so that's how I got here. Yeah, I think it was probably dissatisfaction, Carl. I love teaching. I really did, and I love the kids. And I don't mean that I should be above being observed or criticized. I never meant that to be. But I think someone observing has to look at the end result.
Yes.
If you're having success and students enjoy being in your class and they are learning something, I think you have to give some latitude to people. A lot of those...
Teaching is an art. You can't make a science of it. There's some mechanics.
Yes.
But
yes,
they only go so far.
Indeed they do. And what they do is enhance someone who has those qualities that make a successful teacher. If those are already there, then you can refine it a little bit and supplement with the mechanics, which
right.
is what they do. You're right.
Right. How much did you understand of what was going on at Stony Brook at the time? What was your understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook? The function of the institution.
In the large plan, it was my understanding that it had been determined that a university center was needed in this area of the state of New York. There was a center in Buffalo, one in Albany, and a small one emerging in Binghamton, New York, with the former Harper College, and that really the citizens of this area, the greater metropolitan New York State area, were under underserved by the SUNY system by not having a major university center located here. I think Mr. Rockefeller wanted to make it a what they call in systems, I think, a flagship institution. We were often called the jewel in the crown.
I think it was Sam Gould that used that term.
Is that where it originated from?
So.
He was, of course, he was still chancellor when I came aboard.
Right.
And, I remember that phrase, the jewel in the crown, and it was often said that this Stony Brook held a special place in Rockefeller's view of the SUNY system because it was one that really had come into being from the time he had become governor. And I remember well that year because my family, we came from a small upstate town, Schoharie, New York, just southwest of Albany. And my grandfather had been a fascinating man. I was only six when he died, so I didn't really get to know him, but he was an entrepreneur. He owned a small electric company that was formed up there, the world's smallest railroad. It was a five-mile-long railroad that ran from Middleburg to Schoharie. And he served in the New York State Assembly, and in 1911-1912, when Tammany Hall was having one of its periodic squabbles, they chose him as Speaker of the Assembly for that year, 1911-1912. He became good friends with a young senator from Dutchess County, Franklin Roosevelt. My father took me to meet Mr. Roosevelt in 1936 when he was campaigning for re-election. My sister and father, and I remember what he was having, he was eating his supper in the governor's mansion. My dad worked for Herbert Lehman.
All right.
Just a, God, I wish we had a few more men of his character and quality.
Yes.
I have to tell you, Carl, I've met a lot of people in public life. I never met anyone that I thought was a more decent, compassionate, intelligent human being than Herbert Lehman. My dad used to take me in on the weekends. A lot of time we'd go into governor's mansions. He did some speech writing for him on agricultural matters. And I had a lot of chances to see him as a small boy.
Did you know that I interviewed Lehman with a stenotypist at the end of the war when I was doing my the Empire State at War, World War II?
No, I did not. 1945? Did you do that? 46?
It was 45, 46.
Uh-huh.
It was in 46. Down in his apartment in New York City. He interviewed Paletti also.
Oh, the marvelous Charles Paletti.
Yeah.
Oh, what a sweetheart he was. They came out to my sister's wedding. She was married in 1939. I had an attack of flu or something, and I was up in my bedroom with my buddy, and I was just wrapped up. God, into the bedroom comes Charles Paletti. And he was marvelous. He joked around with us. He said, sit down. He went back to Italy, I think. He was acting governor.
Yes, he was acting governor. I don't know what happened.
I lost track of him.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's
probably
dead now.
Yeah.
But he was a nice man. And Lehman, I just thought he was... Not only the other things, he was a tremendous governor. What an outstanding administrator. I mean, he inherited some problems from Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin went off to bigger things. And he eliminated the debt. He built a surplus. He expanded schools. He did a lot of things, Lehman. It's an old fashioned.
Yes, his picture is in the book. The book is published by the state of New York.
Good. Good. Well, there have been some good, well, I have to say men because there's never been a woman governor in the state, but there have been some good men who have served as governors in New York.
Quality's gone downhill in the last
I think so.
Eight years.
Sad.
Yeah.
Sad. I certainly didn't always agree with Mr. Dewey, but I think he was deal about the state.
We owe the state university time.
Yes, that's correct, because 1948 came together. Dewey was supportive of that.
And he appointed the commission to look into the need for state university and appointed Young as chairman. Owen D. Young.
Owen D. Young,
yep. All right, what were your impressions of Stony Brook when you first came? The campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit.
Well, I had a sense that there was a strong spirit, a strong esprit de corps. It seemed to me a lot like a family here, a fairly large family. There were only 250 faculty here and less than 1,000 undergraduates at that time, and I remember there were only 16 buildings, I think, on the campus at that time. So you knew people all over the campus, and it was easy to expedite things. You just pick up the phone and call so-and-so, and it didn't seem to me at that time it wasn't necessary to put everything into memoranda form. People were still honorable, and their word meant something, and if you made some agreement, you didn't think about it. If somebody agreed to do something, you knew that it would be done, and if there were a problem getting it done, that person would have gotten back to you and told you about it. So I think there was a lot of spirit there, and Johnny, of course, was the most fascinating person I think I've ever met here. In fact, perhaps met anywhere. I've never seen anyone with such energy. I remember Ed arranged for him to come down and meet us. We were at that time, the admissions office was in one of the dorms over in
G-Quad
it was. Right. I know where it is, I just don't know the name of that thing. And we were on the lookout for him coming down because the administration building, as you knew, was in the library at that time up on the third floor. And he wasn't walking, he was running. Presidents don't run. And he came in and talked to us at that time. And he had such an amazing grasp of detail.
Yeah.
Sure, you knew that.
He could carry more things in his front mind, in consciousness, at the same time than any person that I knew.
That was my experience.
And he was open and without guile. He's a good man to work for.
I felt so. I think he was largely misunderstood by a lot of faculty members who looked upon him as sort of the enemy on the campus. And that always bothered me.
Well, faculty have a way of doing that.
Yes, they do sometimes.
Yeah, I know what I'm doing.
But you came to the position that Johnny took over when he came here as a result of faculty conflict with John Lee,
who was
the first. That preceded me, and I really didn't know much about it, but I understand the divisions among faculty were deep, and some haven't forgotten and maybe forgiven to this day, but you were the ideal person for the transition from those difficult days to the time when someone like Johnny could be brought into
it. Ideal? Why?
Well, I think you had the temperament for it. In my view, I think you were a patient person. You listened. You were not precipitous. You encouraged people to speak up, to talk about the things that they had concerns about. And you created an atmosphere that allowed that to happen. You were not seen as a threatening person. You were not seen as an authoritarian person. You carried the responsibilities of your office with dignity. I think that's what was needed at that time. The last thing I think was needed here was to have someone in here who had a very strong agenda
All right.
Now, where were we?
Well, we were there at that point.
Well, I think I was responding to my impressions of your administration.
Right. This was number 8.
Okay. As I said earlier, the campus and the people seemed like just an enlarged family. I found people friendly, receptive, cooperative. I think they felt that most of the people I talked with thought they were doing something exciting and very productive.
Yes, I think that's definitely true.
There was that sense of it. There was good morale, I felt, with the people I had direct contact with in the admissions office and what would later become the departments that make up student affairs, like the housing office and financial aid and so on. One of the things I regretted seeing take place, and I watched it happen even before Ed left, his contact directly with the president began to lessen, and more he had to work through intermediaries. I think the executive vice president office was created around 1967, and Alec, I think, was the, of course, was...
I think earlier than that, actually.
Well, it maybe it had been created, but I seem to recall that Alec was appointed to that around that time. Maybe it was 66.
Probably 66.
It may well have been. Now, that was fine. I enjoyed Alec very much. I was extremely sorry to see Alec leave here, and I thought that he got a very bad deal. All of us in student affairs, all the directors supported him. I had attended a dedication at Coleskill Agricultural and Technical School that when my grandfather was speaker, he designated that campus to be created as one of the ag and tech schools. And so the then president...
The speaker of the assembly.
Yes, he was speaker at that time. And there's a hall up there called Frisbee Hall, and they had had a portrait done of him, and the president had asked the family to come for a dedication, which we did, and that was very nice. It was about 1977, I think it was. And I had a chance to meet I can't remember the gentleman's name. He was then the vice chairman of the board of trustees of SUNY.
Of SUNY Warren?
Yes, that's the gentleman's name.
Yes.
And I chatted with him afterwards when he learned that I was from Stony Brook. Sort of, and I reported a lot of this to Johnny when I got back. He sort of half jokingly, Warren said, how are things going down there? Well, so far, okay, you know, everything's fine. And he left no doubt that they found it very difficult to deal with Johnny. They just had never encountered anybody with his determination and his energy. And he left me with an impression that they would be very happy if Johnny went someplace else. He didn't say it with meanness, but even for him to say that to someone who works for this man was a lot. So I reported that all to Johnny, and he kind of smiled. and I'm sure I didn't tell him anything that he didn't already know and knew for a long, long time. But at the time, I wrote to him when it was clear that the trustees were intending to block Alec's appointment, or that there was some indication that was going to happen. And I wrote to him and I said it would be a serious mistake for the trustees to assume that simply because Alec was Johnny's executive vice president, that his approach to the job would be the same. I said there may be similarities, and I don't say that to attack the Johnny Toll's approach to it. But I said they're two different people, and I told Alec. In fact, I gave Alec a copy of the letter that I sent to him. But unfortunately, it was all to no avail. Alec has never forgiven Cliff Wharton. He apparently holds Cliff Wharton responsible for. He and Judy Myers, I think. Moyers, excuse me. Judy Moyers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she came down hard on Alec. I never understood why. I don't know whether sometime maybe he had met her and he might have said something and she had taken some offense to, but Alec was epitome of tact when he was dealing with the people. I enjoyed that. But anyway, I didn't mean to get off my train of thought. When Alec left, even before Alec had left here, long before that, the admissions office and the whole so-called student affairs area was created with Dave Tilley's old Dean of Students line. That position, as such, was eliminated and upgraded, if you will, to a vice president for student affairs. And I'm trying to remember the fellow who was the first one. I can't think of his name.
He's the one that went to California?
Yeah, yeah.
I can't think of it either.
Yeah. Dave Tilley actually had hired him as a counselor or doing something in the dean students area. And I know Dave was never too high on this guy. But for the period that he was in fact, he wasn't the first one. Trask.
Yes, that's it. David Trask.
David Trask was
the history department.
Yes, and he lasted about 5 weeks and collapsed on the campus, they said, one day. I don't know if it was stress or whatever. And then this fellow was appointed. He had a doctorate, and I can't remember. It might come to me.
Roberts.
It doesn't quite seem that way, but anyway. During his period of stewardship in that position, not much else happened. We continued to report to the executive vice president. Mm-hmm. And then Elizabeth Wadsworth came in, and increasingly all decisions had to go through the vice president for student affairs. But Alec continued to call me at times. There were things, information about this, and him always happy to give him anything. And when I really had a nasty problem that I need, I could go up and see him anytime, unless he was actually talking to somebody in there. He'd always see me, and I could get something resolved. And I don't mean that it always went my way. It didn't, but you could get an answer, and that was important. That's what an administrator has to do.
What were some of your problems?
Oh, sometimes it involved trying to get something done with another office. It involved using another office, and I tried every means possible. I talked with people and gone through all the protocol, and somebody was just going to be stubborn. And it often was in another vice presidential area. So I had no, I couldn't coerce. I didn't like to do that anyway. I prefer to deal with people and point out the wisdom and the value of doing something and hope that they see the sense of that. I can't remember a specific incident. There weren't all that many of them, but occasionally that would happen. And I don't mean that you're going to run to the principal and solve all your discipline problems or something, but often he'd have a suggestion as to how we could go about and get something resolved. But he was receptive. That I remember. And he would always listen.
Do you remember when Elizabeth Wadsworth came?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
About what time, do you remember?
Yeah, 74.
74?
Yes, 1974. She came aboard.
How did she work out?
Well, I think people in the student affairs opened up to her and were very supportive and made offers of assistance. Let us know how we can help. We welcome you to the university. Elizabeth, as a person, was delightful and a wonderful human being. Interesting little anecdote. We were, in those years, often looking to hire admissions counselors. We had some that were coming and going and leaving for other jobs until we'd have an opening. And resumes would come in from time to time. And I had no input into the hiring of the vice president for student affairs and who the candidates were. When they had settled on Elizabeth, her resume was sent down. And when I saw it, I couldn't believe it. It was the same resume that had circulated in our office some months earlier for an admissions counselor position. And my policy was to circulate it to all the counselors to get input. So, do you have any comments? Do you know this person? And so on. Unanimously, they said she was not qualified for an admissions counselor position. I think I told that to Elizabeth many years later, and I certainly told it to her in a very soft way. But anyway, I think she had very limited experience for the position, and I think it hurt her. She was dealing with all men at the vice presidential level who had been in academia for a while and knew their way around. I even heard at times I think she was reduced to tears, and I know she didn't want to do that because she was a feminist. And you never show a man your tears that somebody has gotten to you so badly that it makes you cry. She was very sincere in a person, but I don't think that she was... I don't think she helped that whole division all that much, and she was not helpful to the admissions office. Her interest, I think, lay in residential life and counseling. That's where her strengths were, and I think she was very good in that way. She was not helpful to our office. That was what I was that I had regretted, and we just kept getting farther and farther removed from the chief administrator. I don't mean to add other burdens to that person. I don't envy Marburger or anybody else trying to run an institution like this. But the only way you can do it is to have good people around you.
That's right.
And give them both the authority and the responsibility, and then you hold them accountable.
That's right.
For it. It seems to me that's the logical way to operate. But enrollment became increasingly important after the mid-70s because the demographics were beginning to have impact.
Impact in what way?
In both the quantity and quality of students applying to the university. And what the effect of that, of course, is to intensify recruiting. Private institutions could offer scholarships, other forms of inducements to overcome their higher tuition than SUNY could offer. We needed to have a lot of things. When Deirdre, do you remember one of my associate director? She's now a number three person at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, Deirdre Kadesby. I don't know whether you ever remember. She completed her doctorate while she was in my office at Tufts in English literature. She's a very bright woman.
The first name rings a bell, but I can't bring a face.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't have. She came in about
1975 or so, I think.
You see, I had retired by
You were still around the campus, but you weren't in an active position around there. But anyway, I mentioned her because she saw a great need for us to have word processing in our office. The number of applications had increased tremendously. I mean, when I first came here in 1965, we'd have 3,000 applications. They were read by three or four counselors, each of them. And you could get three or four ratings and evaluations on each one. That was kind of fun in those days because we would get different views on it. But as the numbers got up to 8, 10, 11 thousand applications, to provide individual service required some technology to help us to do the more tedious thing. So she made a proposal for word processing, and Elizabeth shot it down through Emil. Emil's a delightful man. He's the most loyal company man I have ever seen in my whole life.
Emil?
Adams.
Adams.
Yeah. He's still associate vice president of student affairs. Whatever the company line is, Emil would support it. He's not a mean or vindictive man at all.